Session number 31558, reel 11.
And also I made a collection of animals in Tunisia. Got two new species of centipedes and some millipedes. I think one of them was new, and some spiders that had not been seen before. So I collected them, and for the Natural History Museum, we're quite pleased to have it. They'd got nothing from Tunisia, from inland at all. So I had quite an interesting time then. And so by the end of the 1950s, my professor Danielli said, "Look, you're rather junior here because you've missed so much in the war. You'll never get on in this place. You want to look out for a job." And then, so I thought I would. Well, I don't know how they heard of me, but maybe he told them. Next thing, the Foreign Office wrote to me and said, "Would I be interested in the chair of zoology at Tehran?" So I said, "Oh, yes." And so Anne said, "Oh, that's exciting." Before that, somebody talked about having a sabbatical year in America, and we were reading American literature. So when we went to Tehran, we looked at the Ardabil carpet and getting all that up. And while I was there, we were still asking them what equipment they had, and they said three huge boxes of equipment sent from America. I said, "Have you any microscopes?" They said, "Well, we know there's one microscope." So I wasn't awfully impressed with Tehran. And then I saw an advertisement in the Times from the Inter-Universities Council that then advertised jobs in the colonies and so on. It's for the chair of zoology in Khartoum. So I thought, well, there was no harm in trying for that. So I put in for that. All we could find out was Kitchener only, and the relief of Khartoum and Gordon's death and so on. Nothing very in the artistic field or literary field. But I went there, and they were very encouraging. And in fact, one of the board was Norman Millett, who I'd known from taking field courses to Port Erin when I was a lecturer at King's. And he said, "But you left out one of the most important things you do, field work." So when they asked me what I did, I said, "Oh yes, I did do that too." So I felt that it was a rather good thing for me. And so I got offered the job, and they said, "Well, especially I could have a week's out there to see what it was like." And so I got flown out on a Viscount, 18 hours, was arrived on time, stopping at in Switzerland on the way. And I didn't realize planes flew so high then, ordinary civilian planes. And anyway, we got the Viscount, and it was incredibly hot. And I thought, well, I've put in for it now, I'll have to do it. So I went and told Dan, "It's very hot, but you get used to it, I think." And I saw what it was like, and the people were very friendly and nice. And so I went in June of that year, I went out, it was June or July, I went out, and then Anne came out in November after the boys had been, she'd managed to get a place for them in Dulwich, and where they were boarding, except for the youngest one, Pete, who came with us and had his first 3 years or 4 years out in Sudan. So he saw a lot that the others didn't.
What was Khartoum itself like?
Well, it was a bit primitive, really. There were no main drains, so there were buckets in a special little... You had a lavatory with a bucket underneath, and it was emptied every night by southerners who came with a bucket lorry, and they tipped the buckets and put a clean one there. And in some parts they still had camel lorries, camel carts, and there the camel walked along in front and they tipped the buckets into this cart that contained all the feces, and then they gave it a rinse of sorts or put some sand in, and it was taken back to the house, had to be washed by the servants. And there were no tarmac roads except for one. The one led up to the palace, that had got tarmac on it. The rest of them were dirt roads, and every year before the rains, they dug a ditch each side to catch the water. And then once a week, the water would be turned on through jadwals into the gardens to water the garden. And the gardener would come along and put the water a little into one area and then move it into another area and so on, and then it switched off. It was just a question of weekly water supply. But after a bit, they had main drains put in, and then the water supply for the garden was the same, but we had flushing toilets, which was great luxury. And there was one, the first air conditioner was introduced by the French ambassador, and he put it in the room of his house, which he made his wine cellar. And the first one I got in the zoology department, I put in the dark room, because you couldn't develop things without having the temperature under control. It had to be down to 30 in the dark room. But other than that, it was very pleasant. The Sudan Club was quite nice. It was very only English. And we weren't allowed to take guests in. They said, Americans were told if they happened to get invited in, then they could go, but they weren't allowed to speak. They didn't know why they weren't allowed to speak, but if so, they'd been recognised from their accent that they weren't English. So they couldn't come in. It was very snooty like that. It improved towards the end. But nobody had actually joined who wasn't English. Later on, of course, they were moved out and it was turned into a people's palace, I think. But we saw the last of it as the Sudan Club.
What was the political atmosphere like during your time there as Africa was entering the sort of decolonization?
Oh yes, General Naguib, I think it was, no, not, he was on for NASA, the general in the Sudan who was the head, declared independence while the British ambassador was on leave, so it was all done very politely. So when the British ambassador came back, he was ambassador and not whatever it is in a Commonwealth country. And so that there was no upset of the arrangement, and the ambassador's Rolls Royce was still able to drive around. And it was all very pleasant, really. The students wanted to... in our first few years, there was a riot and a revolution. The riot was nastier because a lot of Southerners revolted against what they saw, and quite rightly too. They didn't have a chance there. And then there was a revolution which took place, but it didn't really. That was done very calmly, and the ministers involved were sent to live in Darfur for a while, and then they came back, and it was nothing much, really. The first one, I saw somebody try. They knocked the petrol tap off the top of where the petrol tank of a car, and were trying to light it with a match, but it went out every time they dropped the match in. So they didn't know very much about how to set fire to a vehicle. And I had a shotgun. I put it together and put a couple of shot belt under into it and just put it back, just in case I felt safer. And next door to us was a Sudanese who we knew quite well, and he was, lived, two of his sisters were living with him. And so they came over and they sat and he told us all about the problems from Dongola. They were from Dongola, about he was supposed to marry a cousin. They all had to marry cousins. He didn't want to marry either, and that he didn't want to offend the family too much, and how difficult it was. And he started telling us about that. So we said, would you like a beer? And he said, yes, it'd be lovely. So we had to go outside and pour the beer into a mug. So he looked as though he was drinking a mug of cocoa, and he drank this, and we gave some cocoa or something like that to his sisters. They didn't know he was drinking beer. And then about 4 o'clock in the morning, it got quieter, so they went back and we went to bed for the rest of the night. During the so-called revolution, I was supposed to be meeting somebody, some visitor coming over from the Anti-Locust or something like that. And I went down to the university, first of all, to check on an experiment of mine. And I heard a burst from a Bren gun, a clip of 30 rounds fired near the palace. It was quite a distance off, but we didn't see anything happen at all. They just closed the university for a couple of days, and then it was reopened. And anyway, the students all went on strike. Well, were on strike at the time, so it didn't make much difference.
Outside of those disturbances, what were the relations like between the colonial British, as it were, and the Sudanese?
It was very good indeed. We were friendly with them all. I still got more probably Sudanese friends alive than I have English friends. We were on very good terms with them all. We used to invite them in, and Anne knew them in Omdurman too. She started a physiotherapy department in Omdurman General Hospital there, and got this going with an assistant called Mahmoud, and she afterwards wrote a book about women of Omdurman. She'll tell you about that. And she knew we were extraordinarily friendly terms. And once we had a dinner party, and nearly all the guests were Sudanese. We knew far more, we were friendly with far more Sudanese than with English people. Well, there were far more Sudanese there. At first it was about one third Egyptian, one third English, and one third Sudanese. But very soon it was the English and Sudanese numbers were the same. The English and Egyptian numbers were the same, but the Sudanese had increased very much. It was a question of, it took about 6 or 7 years. Because the only thing that I was interested in teaching them was to do research. So I said, look, we can have politics, if you like, outside the time that you're in the university. But for me, I'm not interested in politics, which is quite true, I'm not. But so I don't want you to mess up your careers in the department with politics. And so they didn't. They were very good. The geologists were they when they went on trek, they tore the ground sheet in half, and some camped under the Muslim Brothers were in one and the communists were the other, because that's all you could be. But with me, I don't know what they were, and I couldn't care less, as long as they didn't show it. And it was just very pleasant indeed. And but after a while, the first one or two had come to England, done PhDs and came back. So that was a start. And then there were more like that. And by the time I left, there were really, we had the publication, the highest publication of all the rest of the university put together. And I think the only second to Cape Town and the Rand University in Johannesburg, in the whole of Africa, were ahead of us in numbers from our one department. That's in zoology. So it was, I think it did very well. But after I left, then it got more and more under government control, and the government made them teach, and more teaching, no time for research. And so before long, I did go later on as external examiner, and so I knew what had happened. And they were saying how difficult it was. I went out more than once, twice or three times after leaving. And Anne came out too. One time because they gave me an honorary DSC, one of two English people. One person that I did know was interesting was in charge of that Pluto, the tennis balls that took the pipeline, not under the ocean, but slightly under it, to Aramanche. Can't remember his name for the moment, but he read geology, and I did geology in my second year. And while I was there with him, we got to know each other rather well. And Vivian Seagrim, his name was, and he had an incredible Elvis car. And when we had this little house in Finery Road, he came to see us from London, and he drove this Elvis. He'd found it in a farmyard as a hen roost. He bought it from the farmer and got it cleaned up. And the drive to our garage in this house would take an ordinary car, but his car was so long, when he parked, he had to be half out on the pavement. And he came and stayed the night with us. And he was saying how one of his brothers had got a VC, I think, and he was the brainy one, so he had that. And when the war ended, as soon as possible, he got demobilized, and he became a geologist. And he was a good source of amusement one way or another. He and I had a certain amount in common, although he was years older than me and far senior in every respect. But he was one, everybody had been tied up, for that possible age group seemed to have been tied up with the war. Val Chapman, who was in the botany department and the supervisor when we came back, he'd been in the government survey and looking at mangroves and things like that for possible landings against Japan, or in case they had to do a landing in Burma, which they didn't eventually have to do because of the hydrogen bombs. Everybody had, there was an awful lot of talk about that, about the sort of things. So many of the things people couldn't really talk about because they were promised secrecy. So he wasn't allowed to say what he was doing, why he was working on mangroves. He just sort of said, "I was working on mangroves." And it took Mr. Briggs, who afterwards became professor, to say that anybody can see that somebody working on mangroves in 1944 was probably thinking in terms of the recapture of Southeast Asia. So it seemed quite obvious then. And the ex-professor of botany at Bedford College had told how his camp, they were taken prisoner by the Japanese. They grew rice, they grew mold on the water in which the rice had been boiled, and made vitamin pills which they issued to all the people in the prison camp. And it stopped them getting beriberi, and beriberi particularly, and other things, because he said he was getting tunnel vision, his retina wasn't working properly, and a whole lot of people would have gone blind without these vitamin tablets. And Hugh Cott, I think I told you about his crocodiles when he was in Cairo in the hotel. Everybody had something to do with it. Most couldn't talk about it. My sister Jean, who was working at Woburn Abbey, couldn't talk about what she was doing at all till about 10 or 15 years ago. And then she was allowed to, and now it's a museum. By the time she was allowed to talk about it, she'd forgotten everything, forgotten how to work a Colossus.
What was the situation more generally in Sudan, socially and ethnically?
Well, the southerners were definitely looked down upon. There was a few I had in university. They came to me and said, the northerners talk about us as a bead, as being slaves. That's not nice. So I was very sympathetic for that, but I said, they're not supposed to do that. I don't have politics in the department. And so I gave a bit of a talk to people and said, you know, I mustn't talk to the southerners like this. Because they actually, the southerners were even more selected to get, had undergone more intense selection to get into the university than the northerners had. But the standards were very high compared with English standards once they got over the problem of English. But I found I couldn't teach the first year. They couldn't get very much out of what I tried because I didn't know enough words in Arabic. We were supposed to teach in English, but by the intermediate year, the second year, I could teach them. They didn't know anything about animals. They never played with animals, toy animals as children. So I used to say, give them spot quizzes. I'd say, where does that animal come from? What does it eat? And they could look and say, they didn't know at all. And then I would ask them the names of things. And whenever I asked them to give puma, they didn't know what it was. They thought it was Boomer. Boomer is an owl in Arabic. And so I had to say it's not. And somebody said, I said, what is a cobra? And they said, a snake from which they make boot polish. Because it was cobra polish was used and sold in Souk there for polishing shoes. And I don't know, they were quite funny, some of their remarks. And I said, if you don't know what its name is, come and draw it on the blackboard. And so I said, Portuguese man of war. Well, that stumped them, but one girl came up. I'd given it my lectures. And she came up and she drew a thing like a ship upside down with sails underwater, and she got mixed up between a square-inch ship and a jellyfish. One of the most interesting ones, I said, all right, we'll do an experiment with flies. So if you cut off their wings, then or one wing, they can't fly, obviously. But if you cut off these little things behind, halteres they're called, that whiz up and down like gyroscopes, they can't fly either way. So I said, next week you must all bring a fly with you in a tube, and I gave them a tube. And everybody brought a fly. Of course, we had fly cultures for feeding the animals in the lair, but I thought it was a good thing to catch a fly. And one of the students came with a bow and arrow, which he'd made out of a thorn from a cactus and a little bit of this stalk of it, and an elastic band across and a cactus spine, and said, well, you go up to the window and you fire it and you can shoot the fly. I was very, very impressed with that. So I said, well, in Paris, they play a game called Fly Loo, and if you wait and put the fly, a lump of sugar down in front, and the first lump of sugar to attract a fly, that person has to buy the next round of drinks. And so they said, oh, we play that game, but it's different. You have your lump of sugar, and you grab at the flies, and the person who catches the most flies in one handful, that's seven and above really counts, will play. He's the one who wins, and then everybody has to buy him a drink.
Did you have much sense of what the British remaining in Sudan felt about the change towards Sudanese independence?
I think most of them, some of them, were thought it was too soon and so on, but I think most of them thought it was a rather good thing in the long run that it would come. They didn't know how it would develop afterwards, that it would become Muslim. It was secular when we were there, and so the southerners and northerners, when we went down to the south, we met southerners there, and we met their tribe leaders and so on, and talked to them, because most of them could speak better English very often than the northerners could, who could speak it by the time they'd got to Khartoum. But in the outlying districts, we had to talk Arabic all the time. Aaron was very good at it. I could manage slightly different sort of Arabic, but I went to Arabic classes in the summer when there was nothing much to do, while she was looking after the children for the summer holiday. And I learnt, and the man said, in the end of this first lesson, you'll be able to read the newspapers. We didn't believe him, but he was right. We could read the paper, but we couldn't understand a word of what we read, because the Arabic, the colloquial Arabic, was different from the written Arabic, which was more like Quran Arabic. So moya, which is water, becomes ma, and things like that. And we spent all evening, one evening, reading one paragraph in the paper about a man, about a lady in Omdurman, who had they had a wooden platform with a hole in it for their lavatory. And it was by law, it had to be 20 feet down. And she was using this to spend a penny, when suddenly the thing crumbled, the earth crumbled, and her whole platform went down. But then Allah intervened and it jammed, and so the family were able to rush out and put a ladder down. She climbed to safety. And we had a dinner party that evening with a couple of Sudanese, Anne and me, and so one of them said, how are you getting on with the Arabic lesson? So I said the story of what I'd learned, and he said, oh, that was my auntie. It happened to her, and yeah, it was very fortunate for her that the Arab did intervene. He was so naive in some ways, and yet very sharp in others, very quick. If I could, my leg iron got stuck in my shoe sometimes, because I still had to wear this iron leg iron in those days, and I couldn't get it out, and I gave it to Dries, and it was our servant, and he said, he went away and he gave it. He says, how on earth did you do it? He says, Hajar, which means with a stone. And nearly everything like that he would do with a stone. Once we had a power circuit, the fuse wire worked, and he got a bit of wire, ordinary wire, and put it in and said, now it'll never, in Arabic, it'll never fuse again. Because I didn't want a surgeon who could speak English, because I thought, if we speak English, we'll never be able to learn Arabic at all. Anne was learning it too, so we had some lessons from an Egyptian. We learned things like, if you don't water the garden quickly, all the trees will die, in very good Arabic, Sudanese Arabic. Yisakan Marturi El Janayna Kois Kuralashya Raiha Samort, things that actually most Sudanese wouldn't have known, the plural of ashjar, shidra, tree, ashjar, and so on, they'd known that. Well, we had these lessons with him, and I picked up some with that. And then when we went on trek, we were talking all the time to the people, to the nomads who'd come up. And whenever you camped, you had to learn, don't throw the rubbish away, leave the tins out, leave them. Within 5 minutes of you going, the Bedouins would come and take them, and they turned them into all sorts of things for roasting coffee corn and coffee beans and things like that. Everything was used. Paper they used for, there was nothing, no rubbish we could have that was wasted. So we didn't have to bury it. We did the reverse. We left it in a convenient position for them all. Sometimes they would come up before and ask us for things, and we did give it to them. And they were very polite and friendly, and they all shook hands and talk like that.